Glorious day, fellow traveler. Welcome to Science and God with Dr. G. That's me, Dr. Michael Gillen, physicist, astronomer, mathematician, and Christian. That's right, living, breathing evidence that science and Christianity are not mortal enemies, but good friends. Actually, an awesome power couple.
Writing a book is a very big deal. You know, it takes lots of courage, lots of discipline, and lots of energy. You know, I never eat more than when I'm writing a book. I should call it the author's diet because even though I eat more, I never gain weight. So there you go. Anyway, so today I want to talk to you about how I got my start in writing and how God radically changed what I write about, right? Then at the end of this journey, I'm going to give you a sneak peek, a sampling of my recording the audio version of my newest book, Believing is Seeing. In other words, we're going to have a whole lot of fun. Okay, so here goes. Writing a book is not like writing a newspaper article, which is how I got my start. You know, a typical article is hundreds of words long. A typical book is tens of thousands of words long. Now, I got my start in professional writing at a young age and in a very unusual way. Here's what happened. When I was a high school kid, I noticed there were newspaper columns about all kinds of subjects: gardening, real estate, personal advice, stamp collecting, coin collecting, and so forth. But nothing on science, nothing, bupkis. Now you have to understand, by then I was a total geek, okay? I loved science, so I sprang into action. Never one to be shy, I called, get this, Professor Richard Feynman. He was a world famous physicist, a Nobel laureate, no less, at Caltech. Caltech is the most prestigious scientific university in the Los Angeles area where I lived. Now, let me make something perfectly clear. I'd never spoken to Feynman before. In fact, I'd never spoken to any real-life scientist in my entire young life. But like I said, I've never been shy. Unfortunately for me, no one answered the phone. So I left a message. I didn't really expect him to return my call. After all, I was a total nobody, a high school kid. But I figured, what the heck? A day or so later, much to my amazement, and that's like an understatement, Feynman called me back. But my mom answered the phone. Now, if you're too young to remember, back then, people only had house phones. There were no cell phones, okay? And mom had absolutely no idea who he was, God bless her. Mijo, she called out to me. There's a man on the phone who wants to talk to you. His name is Feynman or Fanman or... I was horrified by my mom's total cluelessness. Yet I was ecstatic that Feynman was actually calling me back. Can you imagine? I couldn't believe it. So I ran up to her, grabbed the receiver, and swallowed hard. My heart was pounding a mile a minute. My hands were shaking. Professor Feynman, I croaked, thank you so much for calling me back. Then I explained my grievance to him, that there were newspaper columns on every subject in the universe except science. That's wrong, don't you think? I said. I called you because you should write one. You should write a weekly science column. That would be so awesome. To this day, I'll never forget his reply. It was short, sweet, and life-changing. "Great idea, kid," he said, "but I don't have the time. I think you should write it, not me." When he hung up, man, I stood there absolutely gobsmacked. Number one, I just talked with the world-famous Richard Feynman. Wow! And number two, he'd just told me that I should write a weekly science column. That was also a wow. Now, it took me a few days to come down from the clouds, but when I did, I immediately came up with a name for my column. I called it Science Nonfiction, because to me, real science is way more interesting than make-believe science, okay? By the way, the irony is my wife, Laurel, loves science fiction and was even a columnist for a popular science fiction magazine. Go figure. Anyway, next, I sat down and typed, yes, typed, we had typewriters in, out a sample column, and I tried it out on my younger sister, who knew nothing about science. So I thought she was like the perfect guinea pig, because I wanted to write a column that would appeal to everybody, right? The column was about 300 words long, and I titled it Mars or Bust. I'll never forget it, and I still have a copy of it. It was all about how scientists were talking about one day going to the red planet. Clearly, I was way ahead of my time, because we're only now, decades later, actually getting around to making the long trip. I mailed the sample column to newspaper editors all over the country, but they all rejected me. No surprise, really, in retrospect. But I didn't give up. And finally, I found one editor who agreed to print my column. And guess what? It became so popular. I mean, really popular. He eventually paid me $5 per column. Big money in those days for a high school kid. Years later, when I was in grad school at Cornell, a book editor approached me to write a book on mathematics. Not a technical book, mind you. A book everyday people would want to read. All right? I called it Bridges to Infinity, The Human Side of Mathematics. It was about 50,000 words long and quickly became a bestseller. Among other things, it received a rave, and I mean a rave review from the New York Times. Christopher Lehman Haupt, very famous book editor, book critic. Very exciting. In the years that followed, I wrote hundreds and hundreds of articles and another book about mathematics. This time I called it Five Equations That Changed the World, The Power and Poetry of Mathematics. It too was a bestseller, translated into lots of languages all over the world. Publishers Weekly even named it Best Book of the Year. Now, right around then, right around the mid-1990s, my worldview exploded like a big bang. Suddenly, my worldview became big enough to include both science and God, IQ and SQ, trivial logical truths and profound translogical truths. Now, if you've been following these journeys, you know what I'm talking about. Now, because of this radical expansion of my worldview, naturally the topics of my writing expanded radically as well. That's when I wrote, Can a Smart Person Believe in God? And I imagine that people who were fans of mine, who for many, many years had watched me on TV or read my stuff, were taken aback by this unexpected turn of events. It's like, what happened? Suddenly, the devout scientific nerd they loved so much was now a devout Christian nerd as well. Since then, I've written other articles, other op-eds, and other books. But most of them now involve the intersection of science and Christianity, not just science alone. And the reaction from my old fans and my new fans from all over the world has been overwhelming, overwhelmingly positive. Science plus God is a hot topic. It's very, very exciting. Which brings me to my latest book. It's called Believing is Seeing. A physicist explains how science shattered his atheism and revealed the necessity of faith. The publisher, Tyndale, tells me that long subtitles are in these days, and I certainly hope so, because that is the longest subtitle of any book I've ever written, my friend, but there it is. Okay. Nowadays, you hear people saying things like, religion is inferior to science. Why? Because religion depends on faith, and science doesn't. Which really is another way of just saying faith is inferior to logic. Or you hear people saying things like, there's no such thing as absolute truth. Everything is relative. We all have our own truths. You have your truth, I have my truth, and so forth. Which is another way of saying, really, facts don't exist. Feelings and personal experiences are the only things that are genuinely real. Now, these are just some of the claims I myself explored during my winding journey from atheism to Christianity. Claims I ultimately discovered are simply untrue, despite their popularity these days. Believing is Seeing is not a book I ever planned to write. But before I end with that story, step into my studio here at our ranch in North Texas and eavesdrop on my recording of the audiobook. Listen to me read a part of chapter 6, Having Faith in Faith.
When I was at ABC News, I did a story on the Harvard Brain Bank, the world's largest repository of human gray matter. I'll never forget cradling in my hands an actual human brain. The fragile, rubbery, 3-pound vessel of a person's worldly essence. It was both thrilling and creepy. The human brain, as I explained in my report, consists of two lobes that communicate via the corpus callosum, a thick telephone-like cable of more than 300 million nerve fibers. Although the lobes are alike in some ways, they have different weights, shapes, and sizes. Even their functions are not entirely the same. I liken the lobes to fraternal twins. They're an odd couple of half-brains that are both competitive and complementary. The left hemisphere, or LH, controls the body's right side and excels in logic, speech, and numerical calculations. Because it prizes detail, this twin prefers to think analytically, to break complexities down to their simplest elements. The right hemisphere, or RH, controls the body's left side and has a precocity for intuition, sounds, and imagery. Because it values context, this twin favors thinking holistically, piecing together facts into a sensible, coherent, big picture. The LH focuses on individual trees. The RH takes in the entire forest. The LH relishes proof. The RH values hunches. The LH prefers to deconstruct. The RH loves to synthesize. Decades ago, it was popular to claim that a person is either right or left-brained. Scores of books pushing this trendy idea soared to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. That notion has now been thoroughly discredited. We now know that everyone is whole-brained with a fully functioning LH and RH. Quote, "The two hemispheres are both very competent at most things," unquote, explains UC Berkeley neuroscientist Richard Ivory. But they, quote, "provide us with two different snapshots of the world," unquote. Two very nearly opposite, complementary world views. Broadly speaking, the LH has a physical worldview that emphasizes matter, energy, logic, and details. The RH has an intangible worldview that favors images, insights, intuition, and context. An Agatha Christie novel comes alive, for example, because of the left hemisphere's talent for understanding text and analyzing clues. This is complemented by the right hemisphere's gift for picturing characters and intuiting their feelings. If you're stranded in the wild, the left hemisphere protects you by spotting subtle details, such as discerning poisonous berries from edible ones. The right hemisphere protects you by constantly surveilling the surroundings for any threats, as though it were armed with a pair of wide-angle binoculars. As you're about to see, in this remarkable sibling cooperation and rivalry between the brain's fraternal twins, we can pinpoint the sources of enlightened and misguided faiths. The Great Divide. During the 1960s and 1970s, neurosurgeons began severing the corpora callosa of their epileptic patients' brains in hopes of diminishing or even eliminating their seizures. This daring technique worked well enough to earn its inventors the 1981 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. But the surgery also produced some shocking side effects in these split-brain patients. For example, a man named Joe. When a photo of a frying pan is presented to Joe's right-hand field of view, apprehended by the left hemisphere, he readily sees and identifies it. But when it's shown to his left-hand field of view, apprehended by the right hemisphere, Joe sees nothing. Absolutely nothing. But when he closes his eyes and draws whatever first comes to mind, he instantly sketches a frying pan and doesn't know why. Joe's strange experience underscores one of the most striking differences between the brain's fraternal twins. The left hemisphere sees the world, knows about it consciously, and can easily describe it verbally. The right hemisphere is blind to the world, yet knows about it unconsciously and can describe it non-verbally. This blockbuster discovery has enormous implications beyond just neuroscience. First, it demolishes the idea of seeing is believing and affirms the principle of believing is seeing. If you choose to believe only in what you can see and name, you're literally being half-brained. You're putting all your faith in what your brain's left hemisphere alone can see. You're ignoring realities that are invisible to you, but that your brain's right hemisphere can somehow behold. Realities like the frying pan photo Joe couldn't see and couldn't put into words, but that he was able to express non-verbally. These are, I submit to you, precisely the translogical realities I described earlier in the book. Translogical realities are ineffable. You cannot see, prove, or even imagine them. But you can perceive them in their full glory by using your IQ and SQ. You can describe them by using your incomparable verbal and nonverbal human talents, art, music, and worship. And you can believe them with confidence because they are powered by enlightened faith. Edward Young, the 18th century English poet, once wrote, quote, "By night, an atheist half believes in a god," unquote. Modern neuroscience gives new meaning to these nearly 300-year-old words. Given what we've learned about the brain, we now know for certain that even an atheist's right hemisphere is unconsciously aware of things invisible to the eye, including, quite possibly, God. By day, through conscious effort, the atheist can ignore his right hemisphere. But by night, asleep and disarmed, he'll have a harder time of it. Like Joe, with his eyes closed, the atheist is very likely to see past his wide-eyed blindness.
As I said, Believing is Seeing is not a book I ever planned to write. But about 4 years ago, when we were living in Nashville, I was introduced to a man named Dr. Rice Brooks. He's the author of the mega best-selling book, God's Not Dead. I'm sure you've heard of it, right? It inspired the series of well-known movies. Like me, Dr. Brooks lived in Nashville. We were neighbors, and we became good friends. We talked about a lot of things, but one day, and I'll never forget this, out of the blue, he invited me to join him on his God's Not Dead speaking tour. Yeah. For the past several years then, except last year because of COVID, he and I have spoken at university campuses all over the world, from Reykjavik, Iceland, to Tempe, Arizona. During that time, Dr. Brooks heard me speak to the students about faith from both my Christian and scientific perspective. My thoughts were the result of decades of studying the universe and the Bible. One day, when we were in East Lansing, getting ready to speak at Michigan State University, Dr. Brooks told me that I should write a book about faith. In all my years in ministry, he told me, I've never heard anyone talk about faith the way you do. You have a unique perspective on it. It's a game changer, and everyone needs to hear about it. I thanked him, but, you know, I resisted the idea. I had other plans for my next book. But he didn't let it go. Everywhere we went together, he pestered me about writing that book. Finally, I decided that God was using Dr. Brooks to speak to me, to command me to write the book. So I did. Now that it's complete, I realize I did the right thing, especially because of what's happening in the world today. You know what I'm talking about. Misinformation and outright dishonesty are going viral in today's secular post-truth culture. Misinformation and outright dishonesty about truth, about science, my beloved science, about Christianity, religion in general, and of course, about faith. In my new book, I explain that faith is the foundation, not just of every imaginable religion, but also of physics, math, astronomy, all the sciences. I explain that faith is at the foundation of everything. Everything you believe to be true. Once again, everything. That's why I conclude that faith is not just more powerful than logic, which it is. Faith is the mightiest power in the universe. And finally, I track the source of faith right down to the very neurons of your brain. And it is there that I discover why faith is so powerful. I discover why your very life depends on it, every second of every day of your entire time on this planet. It is only when you die, my friend, and leave this world, that you'll no longer need to have faith. Because on that day, for the first time in your entire life, you'll behold the universe in its full multi-dimensional splendor. On that glorious eye-opening day, you'll discover that what your faith right now reveals to you in part, your spirit will suddenly know in full.
Okay, that's it for now. Remember, this podcast is not a lecture series. It's a conversation. So now it's your turn. Comments? Questions? I'm eager to hear from you. There's all kinds of ways you can connect up with me via my social media links in the show notes below. Till next time, I'm still Dr. G saying, I love science, I love God, I also love you, my fellow traveler. Thanks for listening.